Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. We've talked a lot on the show about quantum physics and how it must alter our notion of reality, and that the reality that it projects is a reality with a dreamlike state. Things don't happen as they do in the reality we're used to. Quantum physics gives us a new twist on rules of the universe. Fred Allen Wolfe, now physicist, is talking about a dreaming universe, a picture of this universe that quantum physics gives. And he's written a book about it, titled The Dreaming Universe. He's here to share with us some of his research and current thinking. Welcome, Fred.
Hi, Laura.
How are you?
Here again. Fine, I'm fine.
Good. What got you interested in the dreaming process and linking up the quantum physics view of reality to our actual dreaming process that we and other mammals and such partake of on a daily basis?
Well, I would say the major influence was my whole interest in consciousness. One of the remarkable things about being alive and being a human being is that we are aware and that we are conscious and that we are able to make choices and decisions based upon the fact that we are conscious. And I was always interested in how does that relate to the scientific understanding of the worldview that we presently have, the world of matter and energy and modern physics. And it's through that interest that I began to look at what the dream state had in common with some notions or ideas from quantum physics, and I found quite a few parallels, if you might say, or metaphorical connections which would suggest that there might be even a deeper connection.
Let's go down some of the connections that you made.
Sure. First of all, there's something rather peculiar about the dream stage, as anybody who dreams knows. The thing which is peculiar about it is that things seem to have a rather sporadic jumpiness. Things happen, events seem to happen rather quickly. You might be walking in a park, and the next moment you're on the other side of the world in the North Pole, or flying in an airplane or something of that sort. There's what are called rapid scene changes. And that brought to mind the suggestion that maybe these were like quantum physical jumps, quantum jumps, where there are rapid changes without going in between. That maybe scene changes are representative of quantum state changes that we observe in atoms and molecules. The next thing was the fact that in dream scenes, things are overlapped. You see a picture of something, and that picture overlaps onto another picture, and you have a superposition or super overlap of two pictures. And that, like you would have a double exposure on a photographic film. And that is also reminiscent of certain quantum physical processes. We know that we have something called a superposition principle in quantum physics.
And what principle?
Superposition principle, which says that you can add two possibilities up to produce a third. And these possibilities have a wave-like nature. And that was another aspect of that interested me, was that recent research on the brain has indicated that it processes memory in a holographic manner, suggestive of some sort of holographic wave mechanism. And that reminded me of the wave superposition idea from quantum physics, and I thought, well, that's another tie-in. Finally, there is a fourth tie-in, which I think is extremely important, and that's we've learned from quantum physics that there's nothing absolutely pinned down or defined in the material world, particularly the world at the atomic and molecular level, until it's an observed world. And the act of observation seems to have a disturbing or changing effect, and not only disturbing or changing, but also brings it into focus as if it suddenly popped into existence out of a sea of possibilities. That aspect of the observer effect brought me in line with the notion that there are different states of observation taking place during the dreaming world. There are states of consciousness in which the observer is seemingly unaware that they're even dreaming until they wake up and they kind of have a vague, if at any, memory of what happened. But there are other levels of dreams in which there is a greater degree of conscious awareness until there's almost a sense of controllability, which are called, these kinds of dreams are called lucid dreams. And there are even states that go beyond that. And so the self-observational states in which the awareness of the dreamer changes as the dream progresses, or as a person becomes more trained in learning the art of dreaming, were somewhat similar to certain effects that I found in the way observers observe quantum systems. So bringing all these things together into one, you know, just as my thoughts gathered, I began to see a lot of interesting parallels.
Indeed. Indeed. And tell us more about them, what sense you've been able to make of all of that when we come back with Fred Allen Wolf, his newest book, The Dreaming Universe. From a physics point of view, I'm Laura Lean. We'll be right back. Fred, you were saying, you just mentioned this, I have to ask you about that we know that there are most dreams, we're not conscious of them until we wake up and perhaps catch a fleeting remembrance of them. Lucid dreaming, where you're awake inside your dream, you're aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. And you said that there were states that go beyond that. What are they, and what are the terms that we use to describe them?
The terminology is still being defined almost virtually as we talk by the scientists that have been engaged in this line of research. They're called, at the present moment, they are called stages of lucidity.
Oh, I see. And like degrees.
Mm-hmm. Like degrees. And they're marked by defined levels of awareness during the dream stage, during the stage of dreaming. The highest levels that have been identified so far are called witness levels. And I think a large portion of the research reported in this area has actually been done in Fairfield, Iowa, at the Maharishi University, the one that was built up through the Maharishi, who's the head of the Transcendental Meditation organization in the United States and elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, the Deepak Chopra Maharishi. Okay.
Yes, that one. And Charles Alexander, one of the major researchers in psychology at that university, and other researchers around the country, particularly Ernest Rossi, who is a Jungian psychologist down in the Malibu, Los Angeles area, and Alan Moffat, another dream researcher. These people have attempted to classify and organize the various stages of lucidity that occur. And, I think as many as 9 have been identified. I find it somewhat difficult, not being a psychologist, clearly being able to differentiate the various stages that they've come up with. But I'm certainly aware that there are at least 3 or 4, maybe 5, separate stages of awareness during dream and during awareness, which more or less are marked by the sense of control and presence and observational power that the person has while the dream is going on.
Oh, we can research that further with some of those guys. The witness stage, so that you're kind of...
The witness stage is like the highest stages that have been identified so far.
So that you realize that you're witnessing, but you feel a little separate from it?
That's it.
A spectator sport. Life is
right.
A spectator sport.
It's like you're playing quarterback in a football game, and you're under a tremendous amount of stress, and you call a signal, and you come back to throw a pass, and suddenly you're out of your body looking down at yourself throwing a pass.
Oh.
And you're very calm. You have all the moment, all the time in the world to watch the scene develop, and you can see exactly where to throw the ball, whereas in a normal situation, if you're in a normal state of of consciousness, you'd probably be very disturbed and would more than likely make an error. Football players, I use that example because that's a well-known example. I used to be a high school quarterback, and I can't say that happened to me all the time, but it happened at least on one or two occasions where I knew just sort of where to throw the ball. I was very, very calm. Even if there were lumbering linemen coming down my neck, I was very, very calm at the moment that I threw the ball because I intuitively had a sense of a greater presence than just being in my normal state of awareness. So in sports events, that often happens. People that are involved in accidents where they jump out of their body, that's another aspect of the witness state. And it also occurs during commonly it occurs during these higher levels of lucid dreaming.
Fascinating. So what kind of, after you started gathering a lot of this research about the dreaming process, where did you go from there?
Well, the whole idea of the dreaming universe was an idea of that there might be some sort of something like a unified field theory of dreaming. You know, the thing in physics is we're looking for something like a unified field, the one field that would explain all of the physical forces of the world. The dreaming universe is kind of like, well, maybe we can explain everything we know from Freud to Jung to physical and metaphysical reality. That was kind of the hope. So I was looking for some kind of overall catch-all which might bridge all the gaps of these different areas of research. And I think the one catch-all notion was a notion of dream time that Australian Aboriginal people profess to and talk about. Some of you may have heard about Dreamtime if you saw a movie called The Last Wave that Peter Weir directed. I think it appeared in the early 80s. It's still, I think, out on videotape or something like that. It's a very interesting movie.
Mm-hmm.
Dreamtime is a time in which appeared before human beings walked the earth, when spirits walked the earth, and spirits changed into the various mountains and streams and also the evolved into the various life forms that we presently see on our planet. Dreamtime is a very deep metaphysical and mystical concept for the Aborigine. It's also something they believe in very, very strongly.
Let's hear more about Dreamtime when we come back with Fred Allen Wolf, physicist, author of The Dreaming Universe. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, we're back. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest, Fred Allen Wolf, is talking about a dreaming universe. Fred, when this sense of dream time that the Aborigines express so well and live so well, when it bleeds through this reality, what's happening? When people have these kinds of experiences and perceptions, is it just in their own mind?
Well, that leads into the whole question of I've forgotten about the time I need to take on these answers. I got to make them a little shorter. It leads into the whole notion of what their original concept is. And the original concept of the Aboriginal is that there is a single being dreaming all of this into existence, and that we are nothing but the dream dreaming.
So that would
all matter is nothing but the dream dreaming.
Hmm. I like that. It's kind of another sense of the unity of the intelligence of the universe, isn't it?
Right. This is sort of like we're walking around in God's dream, and that's
it's all happening in the mind of God. Yeah.
That's the basic idea. And what taking that as a ground of being, then one gets into, well, what does quantum physics say about that? And it clearly points that matter is not as fixed and solid as it would appear to our normal way of seeing, and that it appears to have more thought-like properties than it, in many respects, than one would first see if one didn't have refined experimentation to look at. So when one looks at all these things together, it may be that the dream is something like that. Like maybe this is God dreaming all of us into existence.
Yeah. Well, you know, also when we have the concept now of mind-body, so it is one unit, mind-body, there seems to be, just make that into the larger arena of universe consciousness, of matter consciousness, and you kind of get, you know, an extension of that idea, don't you? So if it's true in one sense, it must be true in the larger sense.
Yeah, I think that's one of the definite things that one finds if one looks deeper into the relationship between matter and spirit, or matter and mind, or matter and soul. These are all various things which one then can legitimately investigate. A lot of physicists today are writing books about it, so apparently it's coming out to be an important topic.
And my God, that mysticism is going to be reinserted into science again. That's going to be fun.
Well, there's little danger here. I mean, yes, science is the study of mysticism.
How do you mean that? That's an extraordinary statement.
Because the
universe is mysterious, and that's why science wishes to find out about it, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, science and magic, or let's say logos and mythos, are the two ways in which the human mind can deal with human experience. And there is no such thing as a perfectly logical universe, nor is there such thing as a perfectly mythical universe.
Mm-hmm.
But all scientific logic is ultimately is reduced to some fundamental myths that we have. They're unprovable statements. And similarly, all basically mythical statements are mythical because there's a logical world in which those myths have meaning. They would, if everything were purely myth-like, then myths wouldn't have. I mean, if everybody could live forever, then stories of bravery and heroic behavior and romantic love would have very little meaning.
Uh huh. How interesting. So, I guess that science, though, has all too often looked at mysticism as the enemy to drive. They're going to drive out the mystic element of our concept of the universe and its quest to make it completely understandable and laid bare. Has been the concept prior, hasn't it?
It's a kind of a nervous, knee-jerk kind of reaction which stemmed from a misunderstanding of science, which was based upon the first 300 or 400 years of scientific discovery. I don't think many scientists would be upset about it as much anymore.
We'll be right back with Fred Ellen Wolf. I'm Laura Lee. We're back with Fred Ellen Wolf. Fred, you were saying that scientists today wouldn't be quite so upset with that.
I don't think so. There is still some nervousness, I would say, on the part of materialism. Materialistic scientists who were still hoping that that there are some inviolate laws, like the laws of causality, or that laws that, you know, that there must be for every effect there must have been a previous cause, that there must be material influences which affect other material objects, and if there was no material influence, then a material object should not move or change its state. There are still many people that think that way at a deep level, but if they understood quantum physics at all, they know that those notions have been basically tossed out with quantum physics, that there's no way that you can have that kind of world anymore. So I would say that any knowing scientist today can't really dismiss some of the mythic elements or some of the mystical notions anymore, that one has to take them more seriously.
You mentioned that we still deal with a lot of myth today, and I thought I heard you allude to or imply that some of our basic scientific premises are just as much a myth as some of the ancient stories of heroes and heroines.
Yeah, they're myths in a slightly different way, but they're definitely mythic. A myth is a story you believe is true when you have no logical way of proving it to be true. It's just something you believe in, like the belief that there's an infinite amount of space and an infinite amount of time. That's something which scientists and many people believe at some intuitive level. You can tell that by the kind of question they ask. What happens if you go out far enough in space? If space is bounded, and what happens on the other side of the boundary? Or if space is infinite, then how far can you go? I mean, those are typical kinds of questions that arise because the concept of infinity is so difficult to grasp, but they're basically based on the old Newtonian view of time and space, even though relativity has changed those viewpoints and changed our way of thinking about them. It's still hard to break those habits of ways of thinking. We're looking for reasons. We believe that things had to have reasons for them to happen. Otherwise, it isn't reasonable.
It's hard to admit that the premises are only workable some of the time and not all of the time if you vested most of your life and worldview in those premises, isn't it?
Right. And for the most part, it's a reasonable way to go about things.
You're a physicist, you're schooled in all that, and you were never caught by those constraints yourself.
Well, no. In fact, I mean, talk about crime scenes, for example. Today we're using scientific evidence typically to investigate whether a crime has been committed by somebody and whether the evidence points to that. Circumstantial evidence has now been made much stronger than it ever has been in terms of like blood clots and that sort of thing, as were anybody who's following the O.J. Simpson case.
I was just going to say, ask O.J.
So there's so many ways in which we're still using that, you know, logical thinking, and it's sensible to do so. It's just that when you're talking about the psyche or the brain or the mind or the dreaming brain or the dreaming mind,
you're on new territory, aren't you? Tell us more about that when we come back, and how do you begin to make sense of it all? We'll return with Fred Allen Wolf. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, we're back. We're talking about the notion of the universe as a dreaming universe. And of course, quantum physics would give us that picture. Fred Allen Wolf, a quantum physicist and author, has some wonderful books out that make quantum physics easy to understand. His latest work is on the dreaming universe, and he's been describing how we can add that to our mix, our notions of reality, the concept that the universe is dreaming us. We're the dream that the universe is dreaming, in an aboriginal point of view. And given what quantum physics is saying now about reality, I think a more and more valid point of view. I want to hear more about that point of view, the dream time, Fred. But first, I want to ask you, and maybe this is the way that the Western mind and experience connects this up. We're hearing so much about the near-death experience, about life after life, and it's captured the popular imagination, I think. I mean, it's everywhere. People everywhere are talking about it. And even if you don't nearly die and come back, many people, I mean, myself included, are having very similar kinds of experiences, inner experiences. And I'd like to just ask you, how do we... You know, when you're dreaming, perhaps you're in something other than the physical reality that our senses give us a picture of. Maybe it's all an interior space, but it's kind of interesting how the interior spaces that people are describing have such a similar landscape one to the other and have such similar kinds of experiences.
Well,
maybe it's another dimension. Maybe it's some other something. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, we need to take into consideration that we are space crazed. We differentiate and talk about things because of the notion that things are separated from each other. The notion that I'm a separate self from you or from any listener out there. These are ideas based upon spatial reasoning. There's good, logical arguments for indicating that the mind or consciousness is not spatially separatable, and that the mind of awareness, the sense of awareness that you have and that I have, is the same sense of awareness that's in every living being, every sentient being, and possibly it is sentience itself that we're dealing with. It's inseparable. So from that point of view of inseparability, then if separation is somehow an illusion, which seems very real to us, then the notion of there just being a single self dreaming all this is not as far-fetched.
Oh, okay. And then the aboriginal point of view and
that's sort of
their worldview.
Mm-hmm. They feel they're part of the dream of the Great Spirit, and that they have no sense, for example, of ownership of land. The land owns them rather than they own the land. There's a sense of spiritual presence that they have in their normal habitual ways of dealing with life and survival that we wouldn't have. For example, if a woman is pregnant and she's walking the land in a tribal way, the first notion of life appearing is when she feels the fetus move inside of her body. At that moment, the spirit of the land, wherever she happens to be, has entered her. And that's when so her baby is now going to be the expression of the spirit of the land at that place, rather than that baby being a name and a creature and having family rights and all that sort of thing. It's more like, this is how the spirit spoke.
Oh, I see.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so that this whole notion is that the people are, it's important that they're dreaming, or their dream time, where they come from and what spirit entered them at the moment of their movement is also a very important part of their culture.
Interesting. And I want to let our listeners know that tomorrow evening we're going to be having an anthropologist who spent years and years with the Aborigines learning their sign language, but also learning much, much more for them. Join us. Named Sean Cahill. That's tomorrow evening, so we'll get into depth into that topic. Did you go to Australia and spend some time there?
I was there for about 3.5 months.
Oh, that's a long time.
I was primarily there just to do some research. I wanted to find out really just about dream time. So I was, besides doing some television appearances and things like that, I was mainly there for that reason. And I had a wonderful time.
It's interesting that an Aboriginal people, low-tech, high-touch, you could say, would arrive at a similar worldview that the most forward-thinking of our high-tech, low-touch culture does. You know, to me, it seems like, well, it's all observation and experience, and you're going to arrive at a similar conclusion.
Yeah. One might think of it as that spiritual presence is God in the future, who has created this great dreams with technology that we're just beginning to touch on through virtual reality and other things of that form. And that's that this might be where the merger of spirituality and technology is really taking place, is that if we could create a virtual reality, for example, that's so real and so vivid. I mean, you can imagine, for example, attaching contact lenses to your eyes so you see three-dimensional imagery. You have earphones in your ears so that you're having three-dimensional holographic holophonic sound. You can imagine sensory electrodes placed at various parts in your brain so that you're experiencing feelings and smells and tastes and whatever, and you could just be totally lying still, creating a universe inside of your brain, and it'll look pretty real.
Well, who's to say we're not already, our human physical bodies are not virtual reality machines that our souls are operating under to provide ourselves experience in this waveform universe.
Right.
I know that you have always fun in store during workshops. I remember the first time I met you, I went to one of your workshops when you had one here in Bellevue, and you had been talking about shamans of the rainforest, and I had the most amazing experience with that when you played some drumming and recreated the experience.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing how certain elements can really induce quite an inner experience. How do you encourage people to partake of what experiences might be had to incorporate in dreams, or to incorporate some of these in the waking state, some of these observations or potentialities of experience of a dreaming universe?
Well, there are two different ways, and they're actually complementary. And some people will find one more real to them, and the first harder, or the first more real, and the second one harder. They're kind of like left right brain exercises. One is to sort of think of yourself as a Sherlock Holmes character, and really look for cause effect relationships in everything that happens. That's be very logical. For some people that aren't logical, that would be a way of developing that aspect which is missing in their lives, and therefore making them more lucid and more aware. The other is for people that are more or less logical but have a hard time with spatial, emotional, I would say synchronistic events. They tend to dismiss those as purely coincidental, not worthy of contemplation. I would say begin to welcome more synchronistic events in your life as being truly mystical and wonderful, and expect them rather than to try to always look for a logical worldview. Both are developing towards a higher self-awareness. Both are necessary for a higher self-awareness.
You know, I'm glad you point that out, because too often I see people who are very linear and left-brain in their thinking be so distrustful and dismissive of the other experience of the more synchronistic right brain. And on the other hand, I see people who are very angered in their synchronistic right brain, you know, say, feel like they don't have to participate in the linear, the left brain. And I'm sort of going, hold it, you know, this is a mistake on both sides here. Right. You know, shake the hand and embrace the other part of you and you'll be a whole person.
Right.
That's the idea. God equipped us with his equipment, you know, don't just use half of it.
Yeah, the universe is amazing. It isn't pure synchronicity and it isn't pure logical either.
It's not black, it's not white, it's all these wonderful shades and textures of gray,
right.
The combination of the two, yeah. What other kind of advice? What do you do? Have you been developing your own states of lucid dreaming?
I go through stages. I'll be very honest. I there are times where I don't even want to lucid dream at all. I really just want to watch Columbo on television.
Thank God you're a normal person, huh?
I'm very normal. at times. And other times...
Of course, we never doubted it.
...get away from that.
Well, you know, I think those inner promptings of the psyche have a lot to tell us. It's, you know...
I listen very closely to that. I watch for synchronicities in my life. I don't hunt them down. I don't try to make them happen. I just watch them. When they do happen, I pay attention.
What's a recent one that you can tell us about?
Well, I'm getting married at the end of October.
Uh-huh.
Through a synchronistic event that took place on my way to Egypt. I was going to Egypt to do research on my next book, which is about the human soul. And while I was there, some rather amazing synchronistic events that took place that allowed me to meet my present fiancé. So that was rather striking. Also, in Egypt... I found, as I think many people do, and for that reason, some people tend to dismiss this as just, you know, silliness, but I found Egypt, the whole experience to be very magical. I was able to feel a sense of time travel, and I could identify very clearly with some of the ancient Egyptian mythical spiritual characters.
The
whole Osiris myth has a great deal of meaning for me, and the particular character of Thoth, who is the scribe scientist, the one with the heron-headed, you know, a human body, but a heron head or an ibis head, is very important to me. And the whole story of what happens to this character whose soul is going into to be evaluated in the court of Osiris, the court of the Netter world or the underworld, all that legendary story. Was unfolding for me just the moment that I was beginning to do my research on my book on soul evidence. Now, you may say I was looking for it, but I didn't know what I was looking for when I went there. I had no idea that the story of the soul was so much very much a story of the Egyptian mythology. And there were some interesting coincidences between that and Kabbalah that I discovered when I was there as well.
Between Egypt and the Kabbalah?
Yes. There's some strong connections between ancient Hebrew and the ancient terminology that the Egyptians used in their language and so forth.
Well, they were neighbors. I always see this cross-fertilization of cultures through time and through distance in geography more and more and more as more and more research are being brought up about that. We'll return with Fred Alan Wolf. We'll be back. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here with physicist Fred Alan Wolf, not just any old physicist, a quantum physicist, which I think is the most forward-thinking of the bunch. Fred, you've looked at shamanism, now dreams, souls, UFO. I've heard a UFO lecture that you gave. And what you're doing is connecting all these up in the basis of looking through the lens of quantum physics and what it has to say about these phenomenons and experiences. Can you give us kind of a general connecting ground between these topics?
There are a lot of strong overlapping themes. For example, there's a very striking parallel between the appearance of of the extraterrestrial beings that Close Encounter people report, and the appearances of starving Biafran and other children that we've witnessed on television over a number of years. That's a rather remarkable connection. There is a remarkable connection in that a large number of people that have had Close Encounter phenomena where they've been tortured, prodded, examined, usually through some sort of perverted sexual examination of some kind by these UFO creatures. They're not always the most benign or nicest creatures in the world. That these beings, these people that have had these experiences, have also been observed later on, or to have found out that many of them had been molested as children. So, you know, before you jump to any conclusion of what that means, I'm just pointing out parallels. A number of the UFO visions that people have had or seen are strikingly reminiscent of certain UFO phenomena that have appeared in George Pal movies, like when the Martians came and that sort of thing. Does this mean that people are just bringing up fantasy material? Well, that's dismissing it, very, very clearly dismissing it. I would say there's overlapping realities here. Why does George Pell make fantasy movies in which flying saucers look the way they do? Where do those visions come from?
George who? What are we talking about?
George Pell, the guy who used to make Invasions from Mars, these color movies back in the 50s.
Oh, kind of the B-grade movies, okay.
Yes. They were actually better than grade B. They were pretty, fairly good movies. Right now we have Star Trek as being, as setting a new stage in contact, and I imagine within 5 or 10 years we're going to have people having Star Trek-like creatures coming to visit them.
Well, you know, there's something about... let me just say, there's something about Gene Roddenberry, as a friend of mine points out, being the Jules Verne of today, and maybe it takes someone with a fertile imagination to lay out possibilities that we then dream into existence, just like Jules Verne in his day was talking about fantastic inventions. What do? We went and invented them.
Yeah, if we go back in time, all the way back in time, we'll find, without making any pejorative sense to this, that we've had fairy tale, leprechauns, elves, flying saucers, fairy folk infiltrating our lives from the time of the great visions of wheels within wheels in the Bible.
We need to break, but when we come back, let's talk more about that and develop that theme with Fred Ellen Wolf. I'm Laura Lee. We're talking about quantum physics and how it can change our notions of reality, especially as to do with dreams, but not only dreams, but shamanism we touched on, the soul, UFOs, and just life in general, our experiences. And quantum physicist Fred Ellen Wolf joins us. It's WOLF. If you're looking for his many titles in the bookstore, you'll probably find them under the science section. He's very good at making quantum physics and all the various realms in which it has something to say very understandable to we the layperson. We appreciate that from you, Fred. You were just telling us a little bit about how shamanism, dreams, the soul, UFOs, and all these various aspects that you have researched in depth in terms of their relationship to quantum physics, what all this has to say. I mean, there's no one answer, of course, and there's no easy, compact answer, but we can begin to put things together, as you have done, to draw some parallels and to see some of these overlapping realities and maybe shed some new light on some of these anomalistic phenomena and some of these very old cultural phenomena, and start to bring them all into a map, pieces of the puzzle to put together, because this is a puzzling reality. And I think that nowadays people are so confused. I think there's a general state of confusion out there because it's all in motion now. We don't have the mindset that we are so sure anymore of what's going on. Science, when it lays new ground, of course, is covering new territory, pushing past the previous comfort zone. And I think it's an exciting time, but also a time where we need to begin to ask questions that had heretofore been either off territory or never came up to be questioned.
Right. I totally agree.
Can you address, you were laying out a kind of a vision. You were saying that Oh, you made some interesting parallels between the appearance of extraterrestrials as people who claim to be abducted, describe them in starving Biafrans. I hadn't heard that before. That's fascinating. We're finding out more and more the high number of people that have undergone sexual abuse, UFO visions and movies. You know, why are some of those UFOs looking like the props out of some of these 50s sci-fi movies? I just can't fathom that one.
Well, there's a correlation, clearly, between the imagery of UFOs and imagery that we've either seen on television or experiences that we've had as children. What are these things telling us? The video television imagery is one part of some kind of collective brain operating or collective mind operating, and it's very deeply tied into the unconscious, which is considered by Jung to be universal, existing in all of us at the same time, not just
Oh, it's like the screen, the cinema, the television would be like the screen of the collective subconscious.
Right. Hmm. So if you tie the notion there's a single consciousness here that is attempting to wake up, it's to come into some greater awareness, there are certain things to be gained by that, clearly. We might become more peacefully aligned with each other and have less serious ways of hurting each other and stop hurting each other altogether as we awaken. But we may become to realize that we are just one being, that this is one soul's dream.
Now that could stop war right there in our tracks, couldn't it?
Well, it could, but then there's a sudden realization that you're all one. You are alone. You are it. That's it. You are it. And then there's a sudden realization that there's nothing else but you, and it's always been only you. And then that
maybe that's why we fractured then, or it fractured in order to have some company, or the illusion of company.
That's the next point. That what we have to do to have company, and the other thing is we have to. Well, that means that if company or the presence of more than one being is something you're sensing. And if it isn't true, well, then that must be an illusion. That must be the great Maya. So that means that some way God, you, has fallen asleep and is having a dream in which this is all taking place as separate beings. So you, God, must be a little bit less than God in order for this to happen.
God asleep at the wheel. No, I don't think so. Maybe it's just one of those many faceted states of awareness or something, or the grand experiment. Let's explore this more. This is a fascinating theme. It's not something that we can truly separate like you can with a physics experiment, because it's what are we? We're the subject, really, and in the experiment as well as the experiment itself and the observer all in one. So maybe that's why it gets into that quantum dreamlike aspects.
I think the thing that we're learning to recognize more and more is that that wherever you go, there you are, so to speak, that you are present in all observation, and that you can't really distinguish a totally free objective reality separate from your perceptions of it.
Well, on the other hand, every time that physicists, this is not true, do an experiment like Galileo with the balls running down the slope way back when, or Da Vinci, whoever it was, he was getting the same consistent results. I mean, that's why science was founded at the time, is because, and Newton, I'm told by Rick Levine, was just as much a mystic as he was a scientist. In fact, because he was a mystic and wanted to know more about this mysticism of the universe, as you pointed out earlier, science, he turned to science, tried to lend a mathematical language to understanding how it all works in that one aspect of it. But he was getting consistent results. He wasn't changing the outcome of the experiment simply by his observation of it. So aren't there some experiments where the observer effect doesn't happen, obviously?
No.
No, really?
No, it's
too minute to measure. I mean,
what's that?
Too minute to measure. I mean,
well, no. I mean, in any Newton experiment, even the largest object that you drop and let it fall, and no matter how, for example, if you were to take a 1 gram ball, a ping pong ball, in a vacuum and drop it, holding it with a pair of calipers as closely and as tightly and as perfect from moving as possible and let it fall so that it would bounce perfectly on another ping pong ball that was embedded in the ground, so that if you dropped it perfectly, you know, if two balls bounce together, they will have rounded surfaces, so they don't exactly land. It won't bounce perfectly up. You know, I mean, you follow my picture?
Okay.
You drop one ball on top of another ball, unless it hits right on the dead center spot, it's not going to bounce. It'll bounce off to the side, right?
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Yeah, I've tried to play ping pong on a corrugated cement surface. It doesn't work.
Just imagine that you have a ping pong ball glued to the ground, and you have a tube surrounding that ping pong ball and another ping pong ball that you're holding about 5 feet above it, and you drop it so there's a vacuum in the tube so there's no air resistance. Nothing to buffer the ball around. You're just perfectly dropping the ball so that it just can fall as straight down as it possibly can, okay? And you aim it as perfectly as you can so that it lands as close as you can to the top of the first ball. How many bounces are you going to be able to get with absolute perfection in your instrumentation? The answer is 8 or 9, if that many. And why is that? Because there's a quantum uncertainty in even how close you can hold the first ping pong ball. And that's a pretty large object compared to a quantum. But the effect magnifies very, very, very quickly. Quantum effects are always present. It's just that they're usually very small.
Yeah, too minute to measure.
No experiment is ever exactly repeatable. Even the motion of the planet around the Earth and so forth, that there's always a little tiny error or a little tiny amount that it's not exactly right on.
So science itself isn't banging its premise of reproducibility. I mean, if you really want to get nitpicky and make it exact reproducibility, then it's built on a premise that even it can't uphold.
In fact, the way science was originally discovered was based upon a Platonic principle of perfection. Galileo well knew that experiments that she performed weren't going to work exactly every time he did them. So he invented the concept of the vacuum, or the idea that if we just got rid of the air, then things would look more like his idea of perfection. And of course, he was pretty close to being right. Of course, he didn't reconcile what would happen if things were moving very fast or if the objects were very large, in which case then you would have general relativistic effects, which would then change the Newtonian picture. Or if you had things very small moving very fast, then you would have quantum effects changing the picture. In other words, all science is based upon a myth, and the myth is perfection. Mm-hmm. But never do we ever see such a thing.
Oh, thanks for straightening that out. Just have to get, comfortable with uncertainty and kind of a messy, mysterious universe again, don't we?
Right.
Where do we place our confidence in the universe? I mean, I think it's sort of been misplaced that we could, A, understand it all, and B, that it was going to happen the same every time, you know, this uniformitarianism, and that what was or what is always what was and always will be. I mean, that's kind of a very much a myth that we operate under. Therefore, we get kind of settled into this sense of false security. Maybe would be better to place it in the universe as it is. We'll be back with Fred Allen Wolf. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, we're back. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest, Fred Allen Wolf. Where do we place our confidence in your opinion? Maybe back in ourselves. Maybe back in a... Well, you tell me.
Well, that's a good question. I think the problem is, you know, the fact is that we are mortal, and that the fact of our own leads one to feeling security as being the most important issue, and that's really where science comes into the story. Science and technology have made our life presumably longer lasting and more secure.
Certainly more convenient and easy. Some debate, you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, what haven't we covered here, Fred, that you'd like to mention that your research has come up with in some very elucidating ideas?
One of the most important ideas, which is also in the book, is a story relating to the great physicist Wolfgang Pauli. Pauli was a rather remarkable individual. He was one of the most brilliant physicists that have ever been alive. Some say maybe the most brilliant, even more brilliant than Einstein or Newton.
Then how come we haven't heard of this guy?
Well, he was the inventor of something called the Pauli exclusion principle of modern physics, which explains why atomic structure exists the way it does. Without his insight, we never would have been able to really understand atomic structure very well.
Huh.
But Pauli was brilliant in ways that went beyond just, you know, the making of a great discovery. His ability to comprehend scientific thought and thinking and physicists that came to approach him was renowned. He was also one of the most dangerous people around, in the sense that whenever an experiment was going on in physics and he was in the same laboratory, the experiment would always break down. We used to call it the Pauli effect. In fact, if an experiment broke down in a town anywhere in the same country that Pauli lived in, they would say, "Something must be wrong. Is Pauli in town?"
Interesting.
Sort of a psychic effect. Well, Pauli was also one of the most miserable human beings in terms of his relationships with women, with the synchronistic aspect of the world. He was someone who wrote a book with Carl Jung about synchronicity, which appeared in the 50s. Anyway, Pauli was emotionally disturbed and realized that something was missing in his worldview. And he felt all along that if he could get psychoanalyzed by Jung, maybe he could get some answers to some of the questions. So he did. He went to Zurich, where Jung actually analyzed him, and it was during his Jungian analysis that he had a series of very powerful dreams, which essentially gave him a clue that indeed he was on the right track as soon as he was getting away from physics. He opened up one of his books that he wrote with Jung with a quote saying that scientists of the 17th century went too far. He was implying that the Newtonian mechanical picture went too far because everybody was buying it as being the only explanation for all phenomena that could ever exist. And he felt that the emotional, spiritual, psychic side was not going to be able to be explained successfully by any mechanical picture.
Oh, interesting. See, it seems like when you really get out on the edge, the rest of establishment science, no matter what your other contributions, tends to ignore you or only take that part of you that conforms with, you know, the party line. Is it possible, is this another synchronistic coincidence, or is it possible people could really have an effect on equipment?
Yeah, well, not the effect in the same sense of mechanical. Remember, it's not like, you know, that suddenly this being of great force is emitting, you know, ooga booga ons, particles or something, and the ooga booga particles are making these things happen. It's not like that. It's more of he happened to be in the right place at the wrong time. Thing.
Oh, I see.
There's a psychic. There's something synchronistic going on, and it's more like the cosmic joke or the trickster principle in operation.
Okay, it drew that person to that particular moment where this was going to happen, regardless. Not that they exerted the force that it made it happen. Right.
Yes.
Those two of the big dreamer brought those two things together as a little signal.
It's part of the joke. It's part of the big joke. Like Pauli. Recognizing that there was a bigger principle involved through his dreams, where he had this character that would come to him, who he called him a light dark man, and this character was sometimes would be a dark Persian, sometimes would be a blonde Swede, so he would vacillate, but he was always the same person. He would just change his complexion, so to speak. And this one dream he had, this light dark man appeared to him, saying that he wanted Pauli to get him enrolled in the university as a physics student. And Pauli says, "Well, what do you want to do that for?" He says, "Well," he said, "you're so stupid, you're never going to understand what I want to teach you unless I learn to speak your language. And your language of physics, I just don't understand."
Pauli
said, "Wait a minute." He said, "Who are you?" He says, "Are you my shadow?" Knowing a little Jungian psychology about, you know, the shadow and Jungian psychology. And the light dark man answered him in the same. He says, "No." He says, "I stand between you and the light, so you're my shadow."
Oh, very good.
And this goes on. I mean, Jung has a number of dreams that are very emotionally moving about, to him, an exotic woman was a Chinese woman, and he used to call this exotic, highly erotic woman that would appear in his dreams, he called her his slit-eyed Chinese, because to him that was really exotic. And she always exemplified some aspect about his nature that he was always hiding from himself. For example, in one dream, she was teaching him how to play the piano. She explained to him, "You know how to read music very well, but when it comes to playing, you don't know how to play." It's a nice little double entendre going on right there. And she teaches him something about the nature of music and the reading of music and nature of mathematical equations and the relationship to life, which he has in this dream.
Oh, boy. We could all have such dreams, eh? Maybe we do. Our guest is Fred Allen Wolfe, author of The Dreaming Universe, his latest work, and many other books on quantum physics and how it's changing our notions of reality. I think this is a very important topic to understand to make it through the next era. I do, as things are in motion and we're rethinking just about everything. Our caller wanted to know, Fred, in your opinion, what is the next great myth on the road to infinity?
I would say the next great myth will be free floating in time, breaking the time barrier. The space barrier is something which people more or less feel that they've broken by going into outer space. I mean, it's sort of like it's not impossible now, but the time barrier is, I think, a major thing. So that the myth that we presently hold is that we can't travel in time. And I think that the new myth will be that we can travel in time and that we're going to be learning ways in which to do that. And that's going to be happening, I think, within the next 20 years.
So is it going to be done with technology? Is it going to be done
technology
with a state of consciousness?
The first trips are going to be mind trips. It'll be like waking up in a dream in another world. It's like a lucid dream where you wake up and you wake up, but you know you're still sleeping back in bed. In this case, the time travel, but you travel to another world, you'll be in what appears to be another body, and you have a feeling that you're actually present while you're still present in your original body.
Well, Fred, you know, once we realize all of this, like it's all the mind of God in which this is happening, it's all kind of a virtual reality holographic universe in which we are writing our script collectively as we go. Therefore, anything's possible. We're writing the rules of the universe, perhaps, I don't know. Then I guess I want to ask you, what happens when we finally wake up? We could choose to wake up at any time. Is it an experiment? Is it just, hey, this is where we have recreation? This is where, I mean, no matter how great your state of consciousness, maybe altered states of consciousness are just taking a vacation so you can change the scenery. And maybe this is just one of the possible vacation havens where you have amnesia and you think that, you know, you're really focused in on this little tiny slice of time and space and think that this is all that there is momentarily until you do wake up. How do you think it's all put together?
Well, I think the basic reason that we dream, for example, is to
go
develop
home.
A sense of self.
Develop a sense of self.
So that the self-awareness is vitally connected to how and what we dream about. And self-awareness begins as a process even during fetal development. Here's another remarkable coincidence. Recent dream research has shown that as soon as the fetus is capable of eye presence, of having eyes, that the brain is developed to that stage where the rapid eye movement associated with dreaming begins to take place and occurs for as much as 16 to 17 hours a day during all that developmental phase. This is indicative of a dreaming brain. After all, there's nothing to see. What is a fetus dreaming about? It's interesting that early Aboriginal people say that life comes in as soon as there's movement felt.
That's correlating that, isn't it?
Correlation between the early movements of the fetus and the beginnings of rapid eye movement. So here's the dream. It's sort of like the dream of the planet. The planetary dream jumps into the uterus of the expecting mother and now becomes the dream of the infant. So it's like the dream is like an electrical spark that continues on ad infinitum, and then we are the continuance of that dream.
You know, talking about rapid eye movement, there was a television documentary. I didn't see it. My husband, Paul, did. And he said that there was a woman who decided that by imitating the rapid eye movement, but in a waking state, then she could help people process their angst or their trauma or whatever more rapidly, like they could bring it out of the psyches. And she said, well, what does rapid eye movement do but it allows us to dream? So what do dreams do but allow us to filter and process the stuff of the day, you know, the experiences of the day, and to put it away, put it on the shelf, get it out of the, I guess, immediate psyche. And so she said, if I help people imitate that, and then they could probably process their unprocessed traumatic experiences more quickly. And she started doing this with people, and they reported that these traumas, these phobias, these nightmares, reoccurring kinds of things that they'd had for years and years and just couldn't quite get past, were instantly put on the shelf, dissolved, fini, and that this was really a technique that worked. I mean, I didn't see this. I'm just saying this is what my husband, maybe you, some of our listeners had heard this and want to make a report if you'd seen it. Or have you seen this?
No, I don't know anything about this.
But the same kind of idea, isn't it, in terms of, and also I want to ask you, what is the rapid eye movement? And you've researched the whole process, the physiological process of dreaming. What is it, scanning the inner screen of the mind? I mean, what goes on there? Please, if you have an answer for that.
Yeah, there are a couple of answers. Some of them are competitive. That is, some of them are competing theories. The simple theory, the basic theory, is that you are scanning the dreamscape, the landscape of your dream, in much the same way that you would scan the landscape of your waking world when you're moving from one place to another place. Most people who have dreams probably will notice that during your dream stage, you're not sitting around. I mean, most of us live fairly sedentary lives. We move when we have to. Most of the time we're sitting in chairs. Not so when you're dreaming. If you notice when you're dreaming, you're always going from A to B. You rarely are sitting, or you're rarely dreaming that you're sitting still. I mean, If you think about it, that hardly ever happens. So the rapid eye movement would be associated with the so-called illusion of movement. So when you're moving to the left, your eyes would be looking to the left. That's one theory. A theory is that your eyes are just doing some kind of a scan or a data scan. You're not seeing actual scenes at all, but you're maybe seen flipping during this period of time. And it's some sort of just data scan of another part of your brain. It's more like when you're
it's
REMing,
like a readout.
It's sort of like what happens when you look at your computer, and it's starting to integrate data. You know, so little lights are glowing or going on and off. It's kind of like that kind of a signal.
Well, you know, also we read, you know, left to right, back and forth. I mean, we do that in waking state when we take in information. So it's kind of interesting. Maybe our eyes are just, in a sense, programmed from the dream state to behave in that way. You were talking earlier about the scientist Polly that you were talking about, and
right.
His dreams is having an element of the trickster, of having an element of you know, the big tease of in very cute ways demonstrating to him what he needed to look at or some of his shortcomings or whatever. I was just going to mention that there's an element of the coyote trickster in the Native American, and they play a lot, I think, in the same psychical realms, the imaginal universe, very dreamlike state, vision questing and all that. And even in Zen koans, there is that element of you know, the paradox of the tricky, you know, the universe with a sense of humor kind of idea. So it shows up a lot in culture, doesn't it?
Yes, there seem to be two basic things going on in the world, as best as I can understand it. And one is there is an illusion. There is something going on which tends to obfuscate or make things less clear. And there seems to be a reason for that to happen, a softening, so to speak, a defocusing. And yet, every once in a while, something snaps into focus, which is very clear and very funny, and that I would call a synchronicity. It's kind of a reminder, wait a minute, don't take this too seriously, you know, it's only a dream. It's kind of like that continual dance between, okay, I'm getting up, I'm taking my life seriously right now, my life is serious, it's very important, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and then suddenly something very funny happens that you just totally don't expect to happen, and it completely wipes out you know, all the worry that you had about getting something right in the first place. Events like that continually occur in everybody's life. So I think there's that dance between the trickster and the mover, the one who takes it seriously, continues to go on for all of us.
It is a dance, isn't it? So I guess anything else that you want to tell us?
Nothing I can think of right now.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for, I guess, coming out and playing with us tonight, the way that I look at it. And that's the other thing I think is fascinating for today. It's not only that science is providing a platform for understanding these things, it's also equally so that we are all seeking that kind of connecting ground to our past, our present, to the outer world, to our inner world, to mythology and logic. You know, I just find it so tremendously ensuring that that it's all coming together, that it's one big gestalt. And so perhaps, you know, it's another indication that it's one mind coming together and providing all these various avenues and parallel tracks to come together to the same place, which is a broader, richer, more interesting view of the universe than we have previously held.
Yeah, certainly a more richer, interesting view of ourselves, which I think is probably as important to just enjoy the remarkable time that we have being alive.
And, you know, it's like the inner world consciousness is probably the last, maybe the only great frontier out there. And it's about time we started to traverse it in an awake way. What do you see for the future, by the way? If we dream our universe, then we dream our future. What are you seeing for that?
What I see happening is really the fulfillment of a very great dream, and that is the beginning of human consciousness to emulate and do the things that we've always said only God could do. That there's something about the developing technology which I find extremely exciting in terms of the spiritual quest, not just because it's labor-saving. Labor-saving is a minor aspect of it. I think there will be some great changes in our concept of energy and matter that are going to take place so that we begin to see that they are more dreamlike and less physical. At the same time, we're going to have a new respect for the fact that we are in a physical body and how to make that life much more exciting than I think it has been, and certainly more fulfilling and richer for us all.
One last thing, you mentioned earlier that you felt technology was going to be one aspect of time travel and that it would assist in the process. What kind of technology are we talking about? Are you talking about some of this over unity kind of stuff? My first thought, but I wanted to ask you, what kind of technology?
Well, in terms of the energy problems, something in the line of cold fusion, I'm not sure if it's going to be cold fusion. It might be that we're going to find a new source of energy. Because we may find a new formulation of physics, which says that be what we didn't think could occur energetically is now allowed to occur because we now understand that the physics we had wasn't quite the total answer. So that may be a new source of energy for us.
But what about time travel? How could technology assist in that process? You have to wait, and for just a minute, we'll get your answer. I'm Laura Lee. And Fred, you were going to tell us about, I'm just so curious, technology that could assist in time travel. Now, other people like Preston Nichols claims that some sort of technology left over from the Philadelphia experiment, you know, allowed them to time travel and all this. I just can't quite buy that story, but I'm just curious, time travel, I've always thought, well, you know, could a technology really do it? There's a lot of sci-fi movies coming out with that kind of a theme. It's always been around in the literature. Or would it happen more in a purely a inner psychic sense or an inner consciousness kind of sense?
Well, it's going to happen. It's first going to be a consciousness thing, like a dream state. It'll be a way of inducing a consciousness awareness in another realm.
Okay.
And you won't be able to distinguish whether you've actually time traveled or you just had a dream. That'll be the first stages of it. The later stages of it will get more like the Star Trek transporter thing, where we begin to realize that if we could figure out a way to encode all the information that makes up a human being, that we could send that information over a telephone line into space, and finally, through some kind of quantum effect, faster than the speed of light, which means we'll be able to send it backwards and forwards in time. So it seems to me that that's kind of on the imaginative drawing boards in the next 300 or 400 years, maybe even less than that.
Do you think if we're dreaming the universe, then if we dream that this kind of thing is possible, then it's just a matter of time before it truly is, that we can actually make it possible by dreaming that it's so, that really consciousness is behind the physical laws, the other laws that govern how things are and what might be?
I think that's basically true. I don't want to be overly simplistic, because it's not a simple thing. It's not as simple as we might want to try to make it. It is a bit more complex, but basically that's true. I think consciousness is primary, and that the material world is really a secondary aspect of it.
And sometime when we really get that, I guess we'll change the way that we're living on the planet, such that we wouldn't create the ecological disasters that we have.
Or we'll know how to take responsibility for our messes.
Yep. Thanks again. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
And more research that I hope we can check in with you at the appropriate times. It's always fun to hear from Fred Allen Wolf, because it's very important to understand quantum physics and how it is changing our notions of reality, because certainly our notions of reality are changing. We've got to keep up with it somehow. And I also think that science needs to be democratized. It's too important, because it's A, shaping our world, and B, shaping our notions of the world around us. It's too important to just leave to the scientists. It's something we all need to participate in. So I consider this very important homework. And a lot of fun, a lot of entertaining stuff, because certainly haven't you been wondering about all of this stuff? I know I have. It's nice to have some confirmation for our own inner musings.
This has been Conversation for Exploration, and I want to thank you for joining us on our tour around the universe at large here tonight. And join us next time. I'm Laura Lee.